Well, here we are again. It's time now to review propositions three and to proposition three of the Ozaki Book of the Dead. And as you know, we did one and two, but I'm going to read one and two over again, just so that we will all be on the same wavelength, so to speak. Number one is, every human on the planet has two souls, an immortal soul and a mortal soul. The second proposition is, the immortal soul is a spiritual entity who brings light into the world from the domain of light, the planetary super conscious, focusing the light of the soul of the, that would be the eternal soul, into the darkness of matter through a high self. The souls, the little souls, the mortal souls, guardian angel. And now to go to the third proposition. The immortal soul, sometimes I say eternal soul, the immortal soul is our true self, though we may not be aware of its existence until the very moment of the body's death. And in that respect, I was really amazed to find in Castaneda's, I think it was his seventh book, and which is called The Power of Silence, where a lot of the definitions are finally cleared up. And what he was saying was that a lot of people don't have enough energy. And he always said energy. They don't have enough energy to see anything except through their eyes, their physical eyes. And it's as if you have to have some kind of energy in order to see through your mortal soul's eyes. I think what I'll do is I'll just say, if I say soul, that means more the mortal soul. And the reason I'm going to say that is because of the fact that that's what we deal with most all the time. But if I want to refer to the lotus level in the states of consciousness diagram and the eyes from that level or that being, I'll talk about the eternal soul or the immortal soul. But if I just say soul, I'm going to be referring to the to the mortal soul. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, the condensed form of the propositions, but when I expanded those propositions in the chapter called Propositions Dissected, I think that's chapter three.
Two.
Pardon?
It's chapter two. Propositions Dissected is.
Is chapter two? Okay, chapter two. When I expanded it and I got down to talking about the true self of ourself, and that would be the eternal soul or the immortal soul, and I said, you, and by that I mean capital U, are the true self of yourself, though you may not be aware of your existence, and that means your eternal existence, until the very moment of the physical body's death. Now, it's rather interesting, isn't it, that all of the reports of the physical, of a near-death experience, not all, but almost all, near-death experiences, when people essentially die, like Danny and Brinkley, when they die, and then and he was dead for 28 minutes, you know, struck by lightning. And he literally went up through the tunnel. That's the tunnel at the top of the the conscious self in the states of consciousness diagram, and he saw the light on the other side, and then he came out into the light, and when he came out into that light, then he wanted to stay there, but he was sent back. But now those are the near-death experiences are quite uniform in that way. But from what I learned when I first started reading the Spiritualist Church books back in 1936, when I first started reading them, they were talking about this light. People would die and they would see the light. And that's true in Tibetan Buddhism, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That it's always you die and you see the light. And the purpose is to go to the light and not get sidetracked. And in the way Don Juan explained this to Kashtaneda, and I always wondered how could that be? Why would it always be that you would see the light? What would make it possible to see the light? Because there has to be some explanation. Mm-hmm. There's some sort of psychophysics, because mm-hmm. everything is natural. It's the natural law. But what all of a sudden would make it possible? Okay, Don Juan says to Castaneda, the reason it happens is because when a person dies, that is, physically, then all of their etheric energy is released in a big burst. And this big burst gives them enough energy so they can penetrate to the point where they can see the light. That burst of energy gives them perception. And then it dies away, because it's only a burst. And the people, and Don Juan explains it beautifully. He says, and the people, like the new seers, at least that was his terminology, and you might think of that as the new sorcerers. But he said, they gradually develop more and more and more energy until they can see the light all the time. But it has to do with the developing of energy. And what I've begun to understand is, I think it refers to etheric energy, the same energy that healers heal with. At least that's what I think. Because when they develop enough, then they can move into this other perception of the soul, through the soul, instead of through the body, through the eyes. It's also interesting, as long as we're talking about Kashtaneda, he calls looking at the world with the eyes, he calls that the first attention. And then when you can look at the world with the astral eyes, that is, the soul eyes, he called that the second attention. And then eventually, and it takes a long time to get there in Castaneda's books, maybe eight books, but eventually then you come to the third attention. And then he talks about that as the eyes of the spirit. And he uses the word spirit. But he says it's an improper word. It doesn't really... It's not a good word, but he says it's the best word he can find. And he said, that is, and they call that the third attention. Well, any commentary?
In the Ozaki book, you mention how we become aware of our immortal soul, at least for a short time, when we die, but also through meditation or prayer or other spiritual practice, we can as well. And what you were just saying about becoming aware of the immortal soul at the time of death occurs because of a burst of etheric energy that gets released. That seems connected with my own experience in meditation, that moving into deeper and quieter states of awareness is also an energy thing, that there, it, going along with it, there's more energy present that I experience in some way, and I don't know what kind of energy it is. I don't know if it's
well,
etheric or astral or
it's
what.
A little, it's hard to know, but it just, because Don Juan just calls it energy. Mm-hmm. And he says the human being, when you look at a human being, you see arms and legs. But when you look at a human being with pure soul vision, you see a luminous cocoon. Mm-hmm. And it's rather interesting that when you, often when people see the teachers, they're dressed in these robes, and it's always luminous. They're luminous beings. And quite often, when you see people on the other side, you'll see luminous beings. And all of the advisors that I had when I in 1960 and 60, 50, from 58 to 62, when I was at the University of Chicago, the advisors that I had, most of them were women, and they were all luminous beings.
These were not on the University of Chicago faculty.
I didn't ask. Matter of fact, I called all parts of my own nature together and I said, be sure you shut up for 4 years. And don't say anything. Don't let the cat out of the bag. Mm-hmm. I guess I mentioned that before, but my instruction to them was, memorize everything that they tell you and then repeat it back to them and they'll think you're really smart.
And it worked.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. It worked because they don't test you for what they don't know. They only test you for what they know. So if you repeat back to them what they know, then they think, wow, you really got it.
Well, not only that, but if you try and bring into conversation anything that they don't know, mm-hmm. it's real threatening mm-hmm. to them because they can't allow that because they're the experts.
Well, it's like I mentioned the fact that in the Department of Psychology, everyone except one person was a reductionist. They didn't believe that there was anything except the brain. And in my thesis, I had to use the word tension, because whether you feel pain or not depends on whether you pay attention. Because if you're distracted by music or distracted by ideas, you may not feel the pain. Mm-hmm. And that's what my thesis was on. Mm-hmm. And I had to use the word, it depends on where you put your attention. And one guy didn't want me to be able to graduate, that is a young and brand new professor, because he said, attention, you can't use the word attention because it has not been operationally defined. Well, that was pretty entertaining. Fortunately, we had some little older professors, and they had realized that psychology is probably down in grade one. That is the ultimate psychology. We're just beginning it. And most of the things in 100 years from now, most of the things that now psychologists believe 100 years from now will be entirely different. Not different in the sense that it will be declared false, but it'll be expanded to the point where it looks like A, B, and C out of an alphabet.
I was wondering, when we were discussing Proposition 2, I vaguely remember, you know, what is the impulse that causes us to awaken to our immortal soul and our true self? And in Proposition 3, you're saying we may not be aware of its existence until the very moment of the body's death. So how presuming that everybody in this person, in this conversation right here, has some awareness of their true self and their soul, what allows people to become aware? What is that kindling that brings that awareness into consciousness?
Well, the way Don Juan explains it is, he says he calls the descent of spirit. And he said the spirit is always waiting to accomplish something. Always waiting. Well, this is what the Tibetan says about the high self. And especially in that book, A Treatise on White Magic. I mean, the high self is there and it waits for a whole lifetime, if necessary, just to get an idea across. And so, and the way it was described in some of the Tibetan stuff was the fact that when people are born, they're born with the knowledge, as when they're babies, that this high self, that the high self and the eternal self already exists, and they know it exists.
Then why do we forget?
Well, and the thing is, and it's rather interesting, isn't it, that all these babies are, they don't have beta waves, brain waves,
mm-hmm.
they don't have alpha,
mm-hmm.
they have theta. And the little babies have theta, some of them almost all the time. And then gradually, by the time they get to age, 11? They're about 10 or 11. Then they don't have theta anymore, and they don't even have alpha. Some of them just have just beta.
Mm-hmm.
Beta and alpha. But theta is the quieting of the brain, and that's like Castaneda says, the power of silence. The silence. And the baby's brains are silent. They're loaded with programs called karma.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, the brains themselves are silent.
Mm-hmm.
And so all this knowledge that they have from the immortal self level is already there. Reminds me of that story that Pat Norris tells about the little girl that wanted to go in and talk to the baby and
yes.
finally convince the mother that she should do it, but she didn't want the mother to be there.
But they had the baby monitor, right?
And they had the baby monitor, so they said yes, and so the little girl goes in and they close the door, and then the little girl says to the baby, who's only about, 1 year old or something
like
that.
Not even that
like
much.
1 week or something.
It was a brand new baby.
Oh, it was a tiny baby.
Oh, a tiny. Well, the part that puzzled me was because she says, tell me about heaven, because I'm beginning to forget.
Mm-hmm.
But if the baby was only 1 week old, how would it be able to tell? On the other hand, telepathy
yeah.
is natural amongst children.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was listening to Becky Bailey, a child development person, talk recently about that children, for the most part, don't have words at all in their thinking. You know, they don't think like adults.
They don't think in words.
They don't have the words. It's silent in there. It's quiet. And that's why you hear kids up to like age 6 and some 7, they just chat. They're talking, which of course drives the teachers crazy because they're talking. But that's how they think. That's how they're sorting things out. So they don't have all this chatter. that maybe is what.
So the teacher said, put them on Ritalin.
Helps us forget. Yeah.
Yes. Well, going back to what you said a moment ago,
mm-hmm.
when children grow to the age of 11, that it's all beta and very little alpha and no theta. And I'm just curious if someone did a study, I doubt this has been done, but if someone would do a study comparing children raised in a Waldorf
mm-hmm.
education where the imagination is really is stimulated and enhanced, that these children would have a lot more alpha. They would have beta because they would be very capable of attending to things, but they would also have more alpha intact.
Well, you know, that study has been done.
Oh, okay.
It's been done in a Waldorf school in, not in Los Angeles, but over in the valley, the San Fernando Valley. Because I've been talking with a physics teacher who teaches in the Waldorf school. On the other side of the Santa Monica Mountains from Los Angeles. And he's called me up several times because of the fact that he's concerned about what kind of brain waves do these kids have. And so he was talking to, I put him in touch with another guy, a biofeedback guy, down there in Los Angeles. And I said, you guys get together and make a study and find out. And no, that was 2 years ago.
What'd they find?
Well, I don't know. I don't know yet because I haven't seen any reports and he hasn't sent me anything.
Okay.
But he's convinced that these children are by the time you go through the Waldorf school, you can stay in theta when you want to.
Wow.
That's what he thinks. That's his hypothesis.
Flexibility.
It's
about flexibility.
It's flexibility. Because his argument is, and the Waldorf school argument is, they knock it out of you. What that means is they knock theta out of you. And what they're doing is they're fixing it so you perceive the world in only the way in which, you know, in the normal way. It's like you perceive it our way because that's the only way. Whereas in the Waldorf school.
They is who?
Yeah, society.
The school system.
Public schools in general. Or in the Waldorf schools, it's like, what do you perceive?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I just spent the last week, and a friend of mine named Bob often says it's never too late to have a happy childhood on how our thoughts affect, you know, how we perceive things. And I coined the corollary to that, which is, it's never too late to have a Waldorf education. And I just spent 6 days in a room full of 70 doctors, and we were training in anthroposophic medicine. And so we would begin the day with an hour of eurythmy, just doing the basic letters and the sounds. And then we would spend another hour and 15 minutes in doing just what you were explaining because, I mean, it was very familiar to me because this is similar to other spiritual practices I've done. But probably for some of these MDs who are used to the kind of education our culture, you know, give me the syllabus, I'll write the notes, I'll memorize it. We had to go sit in the desert and look at the four elements in a plant and see how earth, fire, water, air were all in a plant and how we had to use our imagination to see the water and the environment of the desert. And yet, as people opened their minds to seeing different ways, it was it would have been interesting to watch our brainwave patterns evolve over the week because there was this resistance and in the same way, how to look at things differently because then we took 2 pages on diabetes, which had 15 paragraphs, and we spent the 6 days, an hour and 15 minutes every day, dissecting this 1 2-page chapter on diabetes and how the soul and the astral body and the etheric body all related to the manifestation of a disease that we label diabetes. And so, you know, anybody at any age, I believe, if they are willing to shift their focus, can begin to open their mind that way.
Well, isn't it interesting that theta brainwave training, the people who do it, they start getting the same kind of images that people in the Waldorf school get. And one of the people in my family has his grandson goes to a Waldorf school, and now this kid is 9 years old and still hasn't learned to read, can't read English because he's not interested in reading. All he's interested in is pictures and poetry, and he likes to hear poetry. I mean, he likes to look at movies, but he doesn't like to find out anything by reading. And it was only recently that that his mother began to read some Harry Potter stuff. Well, that caught his attention. So he said, maybe it is worth learning to read. But that, I thought that was pretty funny, because he's a typical Waldorf school kid. Very, very bright, and he listens to politics. I mean, he can talk politics like nobody's business. I mean, he's only 10 years old. Because that's because he listens to CNN, and he listens to PBS, and he listens to all of the news reports. This is really funny, and because then his mind is active, but he doesn't want to read about it. But can't help but wonder how far the Waldorf thing, you know, what are his disadvantages?
Well,
the question I'm left with is this move from primarily theta in infants to beta in 11-year-olds a pathological process forced on us by society, or is that normal development? And then is the Waldorf training keeping us what truly is normal, or is it retraining something to be super normal, so to speak?
Sure.
The one thing I can think, just as far as adaptability goes, in a world more primitive than ours, if you don't move into beta, you don't survive.
But here's a question I have about this whole...
Yeah, because beta is fight or flight.
Fight or flight,
yeah,
solving problems,
yeah,
and so
vigilant.
On, and in a very primitive world.
And when I meet people on the highway, I hope they're in beta.
Yeah, right. Well, see, but here's...
Oh, and they found out that the policemen who had accidents had alpha lapses. Did you know that?
What do you mean by alpha lapses?
They would study the policemen, and they had to drive these high-speed cars through traffic lanes,
mm-hmm.
and they found out that whenever they would come to a straight stretch, they would go into alpha out of beta. They'd for just a second or two, but they were the ones who then missed the corners, the next corners,
mm-hmm.
and their tires would go over the line,
mm-hmm.
and this was well documented.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, sure.
Yeah. Well,
training,
I mean,
people to do. Yeah.
Right. I mean, at least as I think of it, that often happens when you get stuck in beta and you don't have the flexibility to get into alpha and theta. Then it's sort of like after you know, the batteries can only keep our nervous system can only stay focused for so long, and we drop out.
Well, although beta is good for fight and flight, I think the book about the Aborigines and the capacity for mental telepathy, and parents in the jungle. I mean, they don't have Pampers for crying out loud. They have to tune into that baby. And it's not beta that's allowing them to tune into the baby and know when it needs to pee or poof, so they're not walking around all day covered with excrement. You know, they know when the baby needs to go, and they carry him over to the bush, and the baby goes. And an anthropologist says, well, how do you know? And the person looks at them like they're nuts. How do you not know, you know? And to me, that's got to be at least alpha, if not theta, to tune into that. That's part of survival, too.
I would say it would be theta, because alpha doesn't tune in, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
But are there different
that's
levels?
A danger situation, though.
No, but it's part of survival. But are
yeah,
there?
Yeah, but it's a different level than.
But I'm saying you need both. I'm saying you need both. It's you don't need straight beta to survive in the
let me,
cruel world.
Let me point out my case. In my case, when they studied me at the University of Chicago, I produced nothing but beta. And one day, just for fun, I thought, well, I'll go into this other state of consciousness. And I did, and it was then alpha theta. Mm-hmm. Went right down into alpha and into theta, and it kept bouncing back and forth between alpha and theta as I let my attention come up from imagery into thinking, and from imagery up into thinking. And it was like theta to alpha, theta to alpha. And so then I found out that I was one of the few people in driving. I could drive for 8 hours and stay totally 100% focused without losing my attention for more than a quarter of a second. And I did this in Germany. I drove on the Autobahn. You know, everybody driving 100 miles an hour. It's really...
And it's relaxed attention.
It's relaxed attention. No tension at all. It's just like fun. It's fun. Mm-hmm. I find, and that's a certain kind of mindfulness.
The Tibetans would call that shamatha.
Oh yeah, and I finally decided that the Germans, the reason that they won't have any laws on the Autobahn to regulate, they have signs that say, 120 kilometers, 140 kilometers, and they have all these signs that nobody pays any attention. Some of these guys were driving 135 miles an hour, that's close to 200 kilometers. I mean, they were kind of, they're the ones that had accidents too, by the way. There were a lot of accidents. But the reason why the Germans don't have any laws or don't enforce the laws about the accident, and everybody wants to drive on the Autobahn and drive as fast as they want to, and when I drove there for 5 weeks, my average speed was 93. I drove up to 110, and I drove on occasion down to 80 when I was letting other cars pass. And everybody is driving in this wonderful way, like a ballet. It's not like in the United States where people are slamming on their brakes and then you have to watch. But it was, everything is so harmonized and smooth. And I began to realize that this was the most fun. And I could drive all day like that, and it was just great pleasure. And so then I decided the reasons, that was a form of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And I finally decided that the Germans, the reason they don't want to have any regulation on the highways is because that's their great
meditation.
Fun. That's where they really have mindfulness.
It's their meditation.
It's their meditation.
Yeah.
It's their, but it's focused on paying attention and enjoying the ballet is what it really amounts to.
Mm-hmm. I have a question, though, about, are there different levels of awareness in theta? Because when we've tested me, I'm a lot in theta. And I guess classically for people that are often in a lot of theta all the time, they're not very organized, or maybe they have problems with task completion and things if they're a lot in theta. And I don't have any of those problems. I balance my checkbook to the penny every month. I'm very linear and very focused, and
what Don Juan would say is that you have flexibility. That's another one of his words. And the flexibility means able to turn from first attention, which is seeing only with your physical eyes, to second attention, that is to seeing with your mind's eyes, mainly the astral eyes, the eyes of the soul, and to seeing also with the third attention, which are the eyes of the immortal self.
So if somebody's lapsing into that space unconsciously without connection with the high self, then it would manifest likely as disorganization.
Mm-hmm.
As a guess, I'm asking.
Yes.
But if there's some attention or connection with the high self.
Sure, and you'd end up by calling him, you might even call him psychotic.
Well, I was just thinking of, I think I've mentioned it here before, my definition, the difference between a psychic and a psychotic is the psychic walks down the street and runs into somebody's energy field full of murderous rage towards her mother-in-law, and she thinks, oh my gosh, this guy's a loose cannon about to blow, and she said, I'm going to stay away from his energy field, I'm going to move across the street and keep a nice distance because he's about to lose it. The psychotic, on the other hand, which would be the person in theta but not consciously in theta, would come into interface with that same energy field, not be able to differentiate and say, oh my God, they want to kill me, because they sense that energy field of murderous rage but can't differentiate that it's not personally directed towards them. And so they're in this state of mind where they can perceive it but not accurately perceive it. Whereas what you're talking about, Laura, is to have that mindfulness set where you can perceive these other energies more accurately.
Well, and it's not even accurately. Again, in my experience of working with people, and I used to work with Menninger patients that were psychotic, I found that I could direct attention and see what they were seeing. But somebody asked me, and I was actually lecturing at KU Med Center, which was a really awkward question in one of their amphitheaters, and I had somebody ask me, what's the difference between you and a psychotic person? Because many of the things I was describing was what they had related to psychotic
people. I would like to mention the difference.
And, yeah,
they can't move back and forth.
And that's what I said. I said
they're trapped in one attention.
Right, and that's what I said. I said the difference is I have choice, and I know the difference.
And not only that, you know that you are at the third, from the third attention point of view, you know who you are.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And everything else is like looking at movies.
Yes. And you can choose. And what I understand it is not that, quote unquote, psychotic people were seeing not real things, but they were caught kind of in the ocean of their emotions.
Yeah.
And seeing all kinds of crazy things.
Well, this is fascinating stuff because Castaneda, Don Juan, talked to Castaneda about this and called it the descent of spirit when he was talking about looking at things from the third in attention point of view. And that means you can look from a high level and you can see all of this stuff going on. And once, and then Don Juan goes on to explain that some of the old sorcerers got so they could get into a state of consciousness in which they could align with this so powerfully to see how it was, that if they didn't like it, they could change it. And that was exactly what Seth, isn't it amazing? That's exactly what Seth said. And he said, every time that you learn how to change it, if you don't like it, then somewhere in an alternate reality, there is a real change. And that real change, plus where you are, makes the reality of you. So it changes. Like, and he gives an example. I can't remember the Indian's name right now, but one of the Yaqui Indians with the Spaniards that fought the Spaniards, and later he was captured, and then he tried to get his people to fight militarily against the Spaniards, and they lost the war, and he was caught and executed. And then Don Juan says, but when the new sorcerers tell the story, they'll tell the story as if that didn't happen. And they'll tell a story like he won, when factually he didn't, he lost. And then he said, normally this is all, if an ordinary person tells this, it is false. But if a sorcerer tells this and puts his hat on the ground as a symbol and turns his hat 360 degrees counterclockwise, that is the symbol that at that moment that he's now tapping into the third attention. And when he does this, it's the descent of spirit. And then it changes, and he's absolutely successful in that other reality Well, that's exactly what Seth said. Remember? Seth said he called them alternate realities. And every time that you have a problem in this reality, if you think about the way you wanted to have it work out, then if you're strong enough energy, the way Don Juan put it, if you're strong enough, then you change the mind of the cosmos. Literally, you're changing the tapestry of the whole cosmos. And then that reality changes. And that reality plus your reality and all the other related realities make up the real world, of which we only see maybe, what, a little fraction of